Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast and a very warm welcome if you're a first-time listener. We're recording this on Friday the 8th of April. A lot of news this week about the climate emergency, energy bills going through the roof. We'll touch on some of that in this podcast. I guess the back cloth is the UN published its report, the news bit of which, you know, that accompanied that report was, it's now or never, which is a bit alarming. And I think a lot of the kind of optimism from COP26 has dissipated somewhat, you know, in those kind of UN energy expert circles. And of course, the UK government's energy security strategy was published this week as well. So we're not going to talk about those things directly, but that's kind of context, I guess. But it's also the end of the week, which saw the very sad passing of June Brown, the actor who's most famous for playing Doc Cotton in EastEnders. And our very talented colleague and EastEnders fan, Ryan Priest, wrote a tech tribute to her in his downtime column to mark her passing. Did either, and we're all super busy, did either of you get a chance to see Ryan's downtime on this?
I did. I thought it was very fitting. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, as a huge EastEnders fan myself, it is really, really sad news. She kind of bowed out of the soap quite unceremoniously a few months ago. It's just like, oh, Dot's gone away now. She's gone to live somewhere else. So she never got a big sort of send-off storyline or anything like that. So, and considering she was one of the longest running people in it, it's a bit of a shame. But then, you know, she's 95. Really, really great innings. As always happens when you get news like this, there's been lots of clips resurfacing online, which are quite entertaining. And one of my favourites, which has been shown a lot, is when, I'm not sure how many years ago this was, it must have been like maybe 5 or so years ago, maybe a bit longer, where June Brown met Lady Gaga on Graham Norton's sofa. And I think it's something about her. I think it's like, you know, the kind of old school sort of theatre aura or whatever that June Brown gives off. But Lady Gaga is just sort of in her, sort of just like in awe of her throughout this whole thing. And it's worth looking at online because she just gets really giddy, Lady Gaga. Oh my God, this lady's fabulous. And she's, June Brown's just a bit non-fussed. Like, I know who you are, but you won't know who I am. So I'm on EastEnders. And she's like, no, I know who you are. I know who you are. I think you're amazing. And there's like an extended cut of it. And it's just... It's very, I think it comes from very genuine from Lady Gaga, but it is, you know, this very fabulous lady, just sort of like, you know, I'm an older lady, I'm sat here on a primetime chat show, but I am running things. You know, everyone is just listening to what I say and taking notice of me when you've got a global pop star, I think like a couple of comedians and stuff as well sat there. And it's just, yeah, it's really worth watching.
Mm, two great icons, of course.
Mm-hmm. What, Graham Norton? Absolutely.
Or all three. Yeah, three great icons.
Yeah, there was another clip I was trying to find, but I watched too much telly, this is a sign off. Years ago, there was a run of episodes of Celebrity Come Dine With Me. And I think it was the guy who played D.I. Burnside in The Bill. It turned out he lived in like a holiday home kind of complex. And it turns out his next door neighbour was June Brown. So on the night that he's just trying to entertain all the other celebrities, trying to, you know, get the most marks for his dinner and everything, she just turns up and is just sort of in the background, just sort of drinking and smoking and just sort of not actually supposed to be there. But it's just the fact she's there and you're just like, oh my God. But you really want to know where he lives. Like, is this where, you know, other soap stars have little holiday homes and things like that as well? You know, it was a real insight, but it was really entertaining just because the fact she is just hanging out, not really bothered or impressed by any of them, but having... I can't really remember if she did seem like she was having a great time or if she was just sort of like, what is this? Who are you people? You know, what's going on? So yeah, definitely a legend.
Yeah, sounds class. The clips that Ryan found are all obviously tech focused, to do with thoughts, tribulations with IT. It's quite funny. We'll obviously put a link to that in the article that goes with the podcast. I love when she's the character. Obviously not June, is just terrified by a webcam. I think we can all get behind that.
Yeah.
In the early days of the pandemic, where we kind of got used to Zooming and stuff. Although webcams have been around for a while, that clip was from 2007.
EastEnders ahead of the times, always.
Yeah, indeed. You're a big fan of EastEnders as well, Claire, aren't you? I seem to remember.
Yeah, I used to be. I stopped watching it a few years ago, actually. But it's always nice when you pop in and you have those reliable characters that you know who they are and what's going on with them. And obviously, yeah. Dot was one of those characters, so it will be sad not to have her around.
Yeah, and obviously you're an Essex person, and the kind of Essex is, as far as I understand, is like the East End moved out, or quite a bit of the East End moved out to Essex land after the war.
Migrated. Yeah, yeah. That's sort of where the accent comes from, I think. It's kind of a morphed Cockney in some way, which is why there's so many vowels in it.
Yeah.
Everything's a vowel in an Essex accent.
Yeah, and it's quite speeded up. There's a similar phenomenon in Glasgow where a lot of people moved out to kind of suburbs and new towns and things like that, but kind of took their culture with them. Of course, there is another Dot Cotton in television land.
I knew this was going to come up. Line of Duty, as ever.
Yeah, Matthew Cotton, the caddy, whose nickname is Dot Cotton. But that's interesting that, you know, Jed Mercurio would have chosen that to be the character's name. It says a lot for her kind of mass recognition.
You know,
you would drop that in as a nickname. Played by the wonderful Craig Parkinson, who's got a great podcast, by the way. I don't know if either of you have heard that one, the Two Short podcast. It's just Craig sitting down with a fellow actor for about an hour and kind of chewing the fat. I've not heard that many, but it's quite a good one. I like the one with John Sim, and the most recent one was with Les Dennis.
Oh, I do like Les Dennis.
Yeah, but that's a good podcast. One of my favourites. Obviously, not my absolute favourite podcast, which is this one. But I would highly recommend Ryan's downtime about Dot's misadventures with technology. So, just to say where we're going in the episode. So, Caroline, you're talking about how rising energy costs have made life quite difficult for one data center provider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're a co-location operator called SunGuard AS, but the UK arm of it. They're a part of a bigger American company, so I have to be quite clear on that.
And Claire, you're going to be talking about how IT professionals are kind of doing in their careers these days as we kind of come out of the pandemic, working patterns, the sort of money they're making and things like that.
Yeah, so we got the results of the Computer Weekly Tech Target annual salary survey, which has opinions on working from home, how that varies from year to year over the last couple of years. So yeah, I'm gonna give you the lowdown.
Sure, more on that towards the end of the podcast. Very kind of comprehensive piece, and it's our research. So I'm going to talk around a quite brilliant feature by Stephen Matheson about wind turbines and the data analytics that powers those turbines, because we all know that turbines are powered by data analytics, and we do need more turbines if we are to save the planet or have a chance of doing that. We'll start with Caroline, also on an energy topic, SunGuard. What's happened?
Okay, well, before I get into that, I just want to say that this story is a good example of why, as a journalist, you should never take things that people tell you at face value or assume you know everything. So just to set the scene a little bit. So the impact the UK's rising energy costs will have on household incomes has been something the national press have been reporting on for months. And the reporting really started to intensify, I think, in the run-up to Ofgem, they're an energy regulator, raising the energy price cap in October 2021. So around that time, I started to send out some sort of tentative emails to some of my contacts in the data center market about what these energy price rises mean for the data center industry, given how sort of power hungry they are in terms of energy use, not in like kind of like, you know, maniacal kind of way. And the response I got to that was pretty underwhelming, to be honest. The feedback I had was that data center operators should be largely unaffected and protected because of how their energy contracts are structured. Many of them have fixed price tariffs that should provide them with some degree of cushioning for a little while, or I don't know how many, but some have made sort of huge strides in trying to increase the amount of on-site generation they have, meaning they can make their own power, And also others have contracts that mean if there isn't a rise in their energy costs from their supplier, they can pass those on to the customers. So it doesn't really affect their business. So having received all that feedback, I was a bit like, okay, I guess nothing to see here. Please move on. So I did. And then late last month, news emerged about the UK arm of co-location operator SunGuard availability services falling into administration with the unprecedented increase in the UK's energy costs cited as a factor. When that news broke, it was difficult for me not to sink into one of those moments of frustration I think all journalists have from time to time, where you're just like, I knew I was onto something months ago, but the news cycle, my contacts wouldn't play ball, or sometimes just the universe decides, nah, not today, it's not happening, this isn't your story, not yet. Anyway, got over that. The timing of that news, though, about SunGuard falling into administration was quite interesting as well, because it coincided with April's uplift in the energy price cap, which again is set to exacerbate the cost of living crisis for UK citizens, but also potentially adds the cost of doing business for other data centre operators now too. And so now with the SunGuard kind of examples looming large, we've got more of an insight into some of the challenges this might present for other operators in the space. So, and I think this is why, sort of like I say, the feedback I got a few months ago was just, we don't think this will have much of an impact. So just to dig into this a bit more, when you look into SunGuard's company accounts for their UK business, it sort of starts to become clear that the rising energy costs were almost like the straw that broke the camel's back. The company was already experiencing sort of dampening demand from customers for its services during the pandemic, which initially was something, when I read that really took me by surprise. And the reason for that is because I think we've all heard lots of reports during the pandemic about how COVID has sort of supercharged the sort of digital transformation plans of enterprises, yeah, the positive impacts it's had on sort of lots of tech firms' sort of financial results. And the co-location sector, of which SunGuard is a member of, has been a big beneficiary of that trend, as the hyperscale cloud giants have sort of lent on co-location players to provide them with ready-to-go data center capacity. So the question was, or in my mind was, so if enterprises are buying more hyperscale cloud services, for example, hyperscalers are buying more co-location capacity or renting more co-location capacity to provide that, why is a firm like SunGuard, why is that teetering on the brink then? Why is it not benefiting from that? And the reason for that is that SunGuard's a little bit of an outlier, I guess, within the co-location sector. It's very much focused on meeting the needs of enterprise customers and not hyperscalers. So they will provide co-location capacity for enterprises, but many of them are sort of pivoting towards using public cloud services and have done during the pandemic. Also, there's a bit of their business model which is quite curious, which hinges on them offering enterprises access to office space during times of business crisis. So for example, if your office suffers a prolonged power cut or it's flooded or something like that, they have sites which have these things, I think it's called business recovery centers in. So they have, some of the site will have a data center in it, but the rest of it will have some traditional office space where your teams can move in there and work from there instead. And the idea was that companies would move into that during times of business crisis. I think we can all agree during the pandemic, we have been through a prolonged period of business crisis for a lot of companies. But the response to that wasn't to move into a business recovery center, for example. It was pivot so everyone works remotely from home and starts using more public cloud services. So I think in that sense, yeah, the move to remote working has almost nullified, I guess, some of SunGuard's traditional previous or competitive points of difference. In summary, while power costs will have weighed heavy on the company, I think what's happened here is that it sort of exposed other weaknesses in the firm's business model and made them harder for it to overcome. And not that I want to predict the demise of any company, but I do think data center operators that are best positioned at the moment to sort of weather the sort of energy price rises will be those hosting workloads for the hyperscalers. You know, they're huge tech firms who are more likely than your average enterprise to have the means to afford an uptick in co-location charges because power prices have increased. And when you look through, I think it was the administrator who's overseeing the SunGuard situation, they sort of mentioned in their response that, oh, we tried to negotiate with customers to take on more charges and higher prices, but a lot of them are stretched themselves, so their customers, so they can't do that. Whereas I think if you're a data center operator with, say, Amazon or Google in your data center, you know, they're already doing really well for the pandemic. So it's kind of like, oh, our energy costs are going up, we're going to have to charge you more. Can you stomach that? I would say that would be easier for a big tech company to do rather than an enterprise who's not quite the size of one of these tech giants, if you see what I mean. Yeah, I think that's why when I initially asked the question back in October to my contacts about how energy price rises are affecting the data center, the response was, don't think it will, because I was probably asking the wrong people. You know, it's another lesson in journalism there. When you have a hunch, I guess, don't ignore it. But it's basically going to be, I think, the smaller players, those who already before this kicked in, who were suffering financial challenges, that will be worse affected by this. But at the moment, I guess it's going to be one of those situations that will probably take a while to play out, just as I guess the energy prices keep rising. And also if there are firms that are affected by this, if they're able to pivot, increase the amount of energy they make on site, or change their business models, sort of accommodate it in other ways.
But I guess the bottom line is that SunGard UK, they have been put into a very kind of perilous situation by rising energy costs. And that, I mean, we wouldn't even have thought about that last year, the year before that, 5 years ago. So it is a very disruptive factor.
Yeah. And you think as well, like if that situation hadn't happened, they've had sort of dumping demand. It did say in the company accounts as well that they had sort of taken out loans and stuff like that to try and see them through this period.
Yeah.
And things like that. So you do wonder, if this hadn't happened, would they have just been able to carry on as they were for as long? And this has just completely just really shook the foundations of the company, I guess.
There is a kind of sub theme in the analysis that you brilliant analysis that you did on this, Caroline. But moving to the Nordics, you kind of examine that issue of data center operators moving more to the Nordics. And
I covered that quite briefly because I did quite a deep dive into that sort of back end of last year. So I didn't want to kind of parrot. Yeah. It's like a recurring topic of conversation that comes up all the time, and usually is led, to be honest, by companies that have data centers in the Nordics. Oh, everyone should look to come to the Nordics. Oh, really? That is surprising that you say that. But there's lots of renewables there. So there's an abundance of quite cheap energy. And it's kind of like, well, if you've got workloads if it's expensive to house your data center workloads in the UK because energy prices are rising, could this be something that makes companies consider moving their workloads to the Nordic, so they can save money? It's always something there's pushback on because there's connectivity concerns with the Nordics. It's a case of sort of distance away from where things are. So it's a bit like, you move the workloads out that way so you can get sort of latency issues. But that is being improved upon. They're deploying more submarine cables and that kind of thing to sort of tackle that. But I think as well, there's like a psychological element with some of these things with where data centers are concerned. But enterprises like to know that they can go and visit their data center or go and see their servers if they want to. And it's a bit harder to do if it's up in the Nordics somewhere. So there's always like a psychological element of like, oh no, I won't be able to go and pay it, like drop in on my server and check in it's okay. The other thing is that at the moment, workloads that do get moved up to the Nordics tend to be sort of high performance computing workloads and things like that, really, really compute heavy, energy intensive workloads. But there's not really, when I talk to analysts and things like that, there doesn't tend to be a lot of demand for sort of general purpose, sort of back office, just everyday kind of enterprise workloads to move out there. I think because it is just, to be frank, a bit of a ball lake migrating them. So I think everyone's in the business of keeping things as simple and straightforward as possible. So it could be an option if things continue. But I think if you've got, I guess, like a critical mass of enterprise who decide, right, things have just got untenable, we can't, we are seriously considering it, and a few go that way, you might see more people follow. But at the moment, it is the more sort of niche, power-hungry workloads that go out that way.
Yeah, always sounds very attractive, moving to the Nordics.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just
better quality of life.
Oh, there's just so few people there. It'd be brilliant. Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And very interesting crime, judging from all the kind of Scandi noir.
Oh, yeah. BBC4 has really made me think it'd be great to move out there. It's such a, from a, like I say, there's not many people there, but then if you get murdered, there's loads of detectives you can look into as well. So,
great. Well, thank you so much for that, Caroline. That's Caroline's been talking about is in an analysis that leads the issue of the Computer Weekly e-zine that goes to press today. And so from one energy topic to another. So I'm turning now to an excellent feature by one of our regular stalwart freelancers, Stephen Matheson. This is the title kind of tells you what it's about, really. It's how data analytics drives wind turbine power generation. I've mentioned quite a few of Stephen's pieces on the podcast. Maybe we should get him on sometime. Cut out the middleman. He always, you know, almost over researches. So there's a lot of detail in his pieces. And most recently on the podcast, we spoke about, Claire might remember this, the first of our COP26 podcast last year, I discussed Stephen's feature about how software can help clean up emission-intensive industries like oil and gas and petrochemical industries and things like that, who are responsible for about, and I think it was 11.6% of emissions. The IT industry, by the way, is responsible for about 2%. So on that podcast, I said IT was a big part of the problem in terms of its emissions. And Claire said, how much of a problem? And I said, oh, I don't know.
Okay. I probably went on about cows or something. I don't know.
I found out, Claire. I went to the internet and I found out it's about 2%.
Okay.
Which, to put that in context, obviously that's less than the really heavy emissions industries that I've just mentioned, but it's more than aviation.
There is some sort of debate about how accurate that is because of people.
Oh, don't tell me that.
No, but it could be higher, is what I'm saying. Because people underreport, and also there's lots of, you know, there's things that are quite easy to track directly, and there's other ones that are hidden, sort of tucked away in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. And it's whether or not people report those. They don't always, because people are bad.
Yeah, devilishly complex business.
I guess as well, you have to define what you mean by, you know, like the technology industry. Because I think, if I remember correctly, which I probably don't, we might have been talking about how much energy does it take to send a WhatsApp. That's not the kind of energy that you really think of. You think about charging your phone. You don't think about using your phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it would be cool to get like a breakdown. But 2%, that's a good place to start. Thanks for getting that info, Brian.
Please don't mention it. His most recent piece, though, the one that we're talking about here, looks at the wind turbine industry specifically. He's got really heavily into this, Stephen. He's joined some network of sponsored by Reuters of kind of journalists all over the world who are looking into sustainability questions. So he's kind of getting more and more into it.
Is he okay?
Yeah,
we lost him.
I do see what you're saying there, because it can be quite a depressing topic if you were too far into it.
Oh, I thought you meant he'd just been absorbed into it, and then you haven't seen him since.
I was thinking more like a cult.
But mental health is always a consideration.
Yeah, we often invoke the danger of cults on this podcast.
Because we're covering the tech industry.
Talking about Silicon Valley, yeah. Now, this industry, it's relatively new. So the UK gets about, I only know this from Stephen's piece, right? But the UK gets about 4% of its energy from wind, which doesn't sound like a lot to me. Mm. But that is 10 times the amount that we were getting in 2010. So there has been progress. There will be more progress. The government released its energy security strategy document this week. But that is going to be more offshore turbines rather than onshore turbines. And I know they've been come under a lot of criticism for that.
But surely they need to go where the wind is, though.
Well, it's more if you have constituents, you're a Tory MP in a rural area, and your constituents are all saying, we don't want those ugly-looking wind turbine farms near us, then they're just not going to get built. So that's something that the opposition has, and I guess the Liberal Democrats, as I'm not sure about that, but almost certainly will have done in the Green Party as well, has criticised them for, not pushing harder on getting onshore wind turbines, which are it's quicker to get them built, I believe. And that just makes sense, actually, because it's like on land, not on the sea. But yeah, the focus of Stephen's piece is the onshore ones. And there are more offshore ones coming down the pipe. Much of that looks like it's going to be in the waters off Scotland. I know we've spoken in a previous podcast about puffin counting, which was germane to or relevant to the building of more offshore wind turbine. I don't know what you call them, farms or groups of turbines or whatever it is.
Offshore wind farms, isn't it?
It's a farm, I think. And what's a collection of puffins?
A colony. Is that a colony of puffins?
Maybe there could be a colony of puffins hanging out in a farm of wind turbines.
Yeah, could be. Definitely could be. I made that up, Claire. It just seems to me to make sense to call it a colony. But penguins are in colonies, aren't they?
Yeah, but owls are parliaments and crows are murders. So I know
there are
like
a variety of these names. Yeah, maybe something else.
A patter of puffins.
Yeah. Now, obviously, readers, listeners can read Stephen's piece for themselves. So I'm not going to go into detail on this. I just flag a couple of things, though. One is the role of data analytics. I wanted to just dwell on that slightly. So he did an interview with Sophia Fannin Howell, who's BP's global data and analytics principal. She explains a lot of how data analytics is relevant here, both in terms of like the planning to establish the wind turbine farms, but also predictive maintenance. Predictive maintenance is a very established use case for analytics. I know when I started covering this stuff in 2011, the famous Dr. Jim Goodnight from SAS explained some of this to me. This way analytics software is used to figure out whether maybe a part of a machine is beginning to wear out. So you have to proactively repair that before it messes up the rest of the machine. It's used a lot in oil and gas industries and I know other manufacturing industries as well. Something called condition monitoring systems, very important here. Stephen's piece goes into that, and Sophia Fannin Howell, like I said, explains this very well in the piece. Now, she actually crops up in our Computer Weekly World. In fact, in one of Claire's blog posts, she is a finalist in the FDM Every Woman in Technology Awards. But the second thing I wanted to flag from Stephen's piece is this is a big engineering story, and that'll please a lot of our readers. Quite often when you interview like senior people in the industry, whether from the user side or CEOs at vendors, they quite often come from mechanical engineering backgrounds. They tend to have studied that at uni. So yes, they're in IT now, but they've got that kind of engineering background. And there's a lot of really juicy technical detail in this piece. So if you want to know what a yaw is, or what a nacelle is within wind turbines, then I'm not going to explain it here, but you can find that out by reading the piece. And to be fair, this is all completely new to Stephen as well. So, but the top line is we need more wind turbines, and data analytics is important for making them work better. And there's some very good interviews in this piece as well. So I recommend it to the podcast, to our listeners.
But now I've got a piece at the minute which is in the works, looking at how things like the technology that's being worked on at the minute, so that the energy generated by wind turbines, because it is intermittent, either you've got wind or you don't, how can we make that sort of help businesses and homes, how can they sort of overcome like the difficulties that poses? Because obviously if you've got wind one day and wind no day, but you want to keep having a consistent supply of renewable energy supplied to the UK's homes and businesses, what technology do we need to make that possible? So we'll have a consistent supply of renewables all the time, regardless whether the sun's out or the wind's blowing or whatever. It's basically like they're trying to sort of do software defined energy networks. And as you can probably tell, that's quite a complex topic, which is why it's taking me ages to write up at the minute. But because other things happen, like data center companies going out of business and tax stuff as ever. So I haven't quite written it up yet. But no, it's really interesting. So all the tech that's going on behind all this, you know, we've got wind turbines on one part of it, but the other elements of things that need to happen to make our power systems renewable, less reliant on fossil fuels and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a really interesting area.
Yeah, no, it's for sure a very interesting area. I think he, as I said, he has gone into this, so he'll be doing some other things around this industry and sustainability more generally. It's an interesting piece, and I have no idea how wind turbines work, but there is a fair amount of detail about how they work and how, like Caroline was saying, software can be used to kind of improve their operation. There's some digital twin stuff in there as well, and kind of avoiding having to go and look at the turbine. Because you're getting all this kind of real-time data coming back. Clever stuff. Now, the pandemic was, and this is arguable, somewhat beneficial to the environment. We talked on the podcast about rewilding and various things, but certainly fewer IT professionals were traveling as much as they often do. I don't just mean their regular commutes, but flying to Las Vegas, San Francisco for conferences and for whatever else they do on their travels to these places. So Claire, you've been crunching through some of our own research about how their working lives are at the minute as we kind of come out of the pandemic. We're not there yet. How much they're making, what their daily grind is like now. So tell us about that.
Yes, absolutely. So, as I said from the top, the Computer Weekly Tech Target IT Salary Survey that we do annually, I got the results in recently. So effectively what we do each year is we ask our audience, our readers, to answer a few questions about, you know, like their way of working, including things like benefits, their thoughts on flexible working, their salary, and then a little bit on diversity as well. So there will be a diversity piece to come out of this, but I haven't written that yet. But I think what we found from it this year is that flexible working is massively on the up. And I know that that's not exactly news, but what I thought was interesting is how much it contrasted with some of the results that we've gotten in previous years when we've asked about this question. So 38% of the people that we asked said that their firms are allowing them fully flexible working. So they can decide when they want to work from the office or work remotely. But that hasn't always been the case. And I think that it just goes to show that the pandemic really, you know, showed tech companies that with proper technology implementation, people can work from home and it's not going to impact productivity as much as they think it's going to. So when we asked questions about working from home in previous years, in 2019, beginning of 2020, so before the pandemic, only 10% of people said that they worked from home all of the time. Which is now true of 30% of the people that we asked.
Wow.
And yeah, so it's a big jump. And in 2019, before the pandemic, 46% said that they work from home less than one day a week. So they might work from home one day a week, the next week they might be in a week, you know, that kind of thing. So like an average of less than one day a week, which again is, you know, completely different when you look at this year, when 27% said that they work from home several days in a week. So yeah, it's a massive change. It's one that I'm hoping that we can figure out how to sustain. And What I thought was interesting as well is that I spoke to, I asked, one of the things that I thought was interesting as well was that I asked the opinion of Alan Worf from BCS. So he's past chair of the BCS Consultancy Specialist Group. And he was pointing out that it's younger people, so Generation Z, and so those are people who were born after 1995. They're the ones that have been the driving force, as he said, behind the Great Resignation. Mm. And in some past, you know, like surveys that I've written up from other companies, work-life balance and this sort of like toxic, always on culture that the tech industry has is something that puts younger people off of wanting to pursue careers in the tech sector. But the people that respond to our survey are predominantly people that have worked in the industry for a long time, people who are in senior positions and people who are older than this generation of people. And yet we're still seeing that working from home, flexible working, short commutes, being able to work from anywhere is something that's very, very important to this generation of people as well. So it just goes to show that it's like the industry as a whole is becoming more flexible, more keen to work from home, not necessarily clinging to this idea of presenteeism and having to be in the office all the time, which is positive, I would say, because these are the people that are in charge. And if they can, you know, like focus on making it work for everyone, I mean, obviously there are some roles where you do have to be in the office or interacting with your colleagues on stuff. But if they can make that fit in with people's want to be able to be more flexible, then I think we've got a good thing going. You know, we could, you know, definitely work on that in the future, work on people's mental and physical health and make everyone a little bit happier to work in the industry.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And what's really, one of the really interesting things about that, your piece, Claire, is it's not just about, you know, working from home either all the time or a lot or whatever. It's more about the quality of life that that then enables. So it's kind of reevaluating what you're doing with your life type of thing. And I think that's, you know, it's kind of harder to maybe put your finger on, but that's definitely an aspect of it. It's not just about percentages and numbers and things like that. It's about kind of quality of being.
Yeah, that's why I bring up mental and physical health.
Mm.
And how remote working might be able to improve that a little bit, because a lot of the people who responded to our survey said that life priorities and work-life balance are becoming an increasingly important consideration for them when it comes to work. And I think the pandemic has been difficult for everybody in various different ways. And I think people have just realized that there's more to life, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting when you're on LinkedIn, actually, that a recurring kind of type of story you see on there at the moment is where companies have announced that, where they publicly announced that we're going back to the office now, or like it's a mass return to the office, everyone's involved. The story that keeps playing out on there is that all these recruiters are basically saying, as soon as a company publicly announces that, we go and target their tech teams, just because they're just like, no, none of them are going to want to do it. And that's what they're saying at the moment. There's this huge churn where for one company that's saying, basically, everyone, we've got to go back to the office. You know, let's pretend that the pandemic never happened. Let's pretend that we've learned nothing from this. The people who are working, they're like, yeah, but I have. And like you say, there's the quality of life element. There's the just reclaiming so many hours in your day by not having to commute and things like that. But also just showing, oh, we're still as productive, if not more so. We get more done. And so the workers themselves, like, as soon as a recruiter pops up saying, oh, well, we've got roles that are like fully remote, working for a tech company, really suits your skills. Okay, see ya, bye. Like, good luck with your return to the office. I'm not getting involved. It's really, really interesting seeing those stories, but it's such a recurring thing on there at the minute. But yeah, it's like, I guess, boom times for recruiters at the minute, just seeing who's next to announce, yeah, we're all back to the office, guys. Brilliant. Yeah, another.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I suppose a kind of basic thing maybe is salaries have also gone up a bit, haven't they?
Yeah, so again, because our respondents are skew slightly older than the tech industry as a whole, the average salary that we find is slightly higher than, you know, like reported industry average elsewhere. But before the pandemic, it was just over 79,000 was the average. That dropped during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I suppose that could be, you know, like for several reasons, hiring freezes or dropping IT projects, people being furloughed, people being made redundant, all because of, you know, like uncertainty. But now we're back up to, you know, like the 79,000 average again, which, you know, like I think is a good indicator of recovery, I suppose. So yeah, I would say that that's positive. But then I'm not an industry analyst. So there you go, you know.
Well, none of us are. And none of us work in IT with these great salaries either. Yeah, the little violins out there.
Just yours.
Just mine. Okay, yeah.
We're not going to make a tiny orchestra.
I might have a little trombone somewhere.
Oh, what instrument should I play? We'll discuss it later.
Percussion. Big.
I was thinking
presence.
Some kind of drum.
Yeah.
But the thing is that you can't get a tiny one of those. Can I get like a tiny, like a triangle?
Yeah.
Tiny triangle. Yeah. And we can lament our kind of relative lack of dosh. I can read Claire's piece and all the other pieces that we've discussed in the episode via the article that goes with the podcast and listen to the podcast itself on computerweekly.com, the website. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Google Podcasts and Amazon Music, which always amazes me to know. Sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this time around. So it just remains for me to say thank you as always to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening and getting all the way to the end. Thank you very much. So until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.